Hello and welcome once again to the Canon Blogger podcast series. This week's show, I'm going to talk to you about Scott Sherman and Michael Stein and their new podcast over at Digital Photography Life. I'm also going to talk to you about how to express your creative ideas in words. And last but not least, I'm also going to talk to you about the latest release of Photoshop User Magazine. In this issue, Scott Kelby's Gonzo Gift Guide and 100 of the greatest Photoshop tips and tricks. As always, we'll round out the podcast with a few questions and answers, and I'll give you a road tip to take into your Photoshop workflow until next week. You are listening to episode number 59, coming up our first segment. To the Canon Blogger podcast series, episode number 59. First off today, I'd like to talk to you about a podcast that I've been listening to for quite a long time titled The Digital Photography Show. And this featured two podcasters by the name of Scott Sherman and Michael Stein. Both also are photo enthusiasts, just like me. And they've really produced a high quality podcast about photography for about 2 years now. And they were over on the podcast network. Well, recently they decided to spread their wings and head down a new path with a new podcast and new sponsors on a new network. Many of us have been anxiously awaiting their new podcast announcement, and the time has finally come for what is now called the Digital Photography Life. And their new sponsors are over at, or excuse me, their new hosting providers are over at Personal Life Media. And you can find their show there if you go to personallifemedia.com. You can also pick it up if you do a Google search for The Digital Photography Life. And I will also provide a link to their show in the notes for today's podcast. There are also show notes for their podcast over on Scott Sherman's photo blog, which can be found at scottsphotoblog.com. And I'll post the link there as well. They have two episodes in the can now and that they've published. Their premiere episode featured none other than Scott Kelby. And in their second episode, they had Jeff Revell on the show of PhotoWalk Pro fame. They've also got some great discounts, some excellent sponsors through SmugMug, which is a company that I use, and I would also encourage you to go to SmugMug as well. And they've got a press release out as well for the new podcast, and I'll post a link to that in my show notes as well. So do stop by over to Scott Sherman's and Michael Stein's new podcast, The Digital Photography Life. Make every shot count. It's a great podcast with two great podcasters, and I know they're going to continue on with the same success that they've had in previous episodes from their former sponsors. So check it out when you get some time. Scott Sherman and Michael Stein at Digital Photography Life. And we'll be back in a few minutes, or in just a minute, with the second segment, Expressing Yourself with Words. Coming right up in our second segment, I'm going to talk to you about how to express yourself in words. Back to the Canon Blogger podcast series. In this segment, I will be talking to you about how to express yourself in words. And this is going to be the meat of today's show because it's going to require a little bit of a setup here in order for you to understand where the topic arose from and how it came to fruition. And basically what we're seeing today in the photography world is a lot of people taking to the internet, both to learn about photography as well as to share their photography and their imagery with the world. And the internet is a fantastic medium for sharing your photos and for sharing your visions. But a side tangential portion of the internet has also begun to Arise, well, it's been around actually for a while, but that's the area of digital photography forums. And you can see a lot of forums out there. I've actually done posts on the blog, and I think I may have talked about digital photography forums in the past. And I do participate in forums myself. I'm a pretty active forum participant on several forums. I've even been an administrator for a photo forum. And I've got a fair amount of experience when it comes to how to present yourself in such venues. And the thing that you have to be careful of when you are expressing yourself with words is that you are doing just that. You're expressing yourself with words. It's not like you have a blog or a website where you can share your pictures and your images and you just let them speak for themselves. In a photography forum, a lot of the times you are dealing with the written word. And this is especially true for educators. If you don't express yourself correctly with the written word, no matter how great your idea is, if you don't express it well in a verbal sense or in the written sense, it can lose its meaning and it can lose its impact. And I've seen in a lot of forums a decreased interest in getting things right, grammatically speaking. And we're always concerned with getting things right in camera or getting things right in our workflow or our post-processing or in our color management. But more and more these days in photography forums, I'm seeing people who are focused less and less on the written word. And the written word can be very powerful if utilized correctly. And it just seems like we're not taking that into account when we express ourselves. And we've got tons of resources. We're on the internet. There are websites like dictionary.com. There are websites like encyclopedia.com. There's an online thesaurus you can use. Even browsers now have built-in spell checkers. And yet there are still so many areas of grammar where people are just not getting things right. And it's rather sad because these people obviously have great ideas or very exciting ideas, but because they're not expressing them correctly in the written form, it minimizes their impact. And the perfect example of this is a recent meetup event I saw over on meetup.com. There was an organizer for a meetup group, and I've talked about meetup groups in the past, and there are several in the Denver metropolitan area. There are meetup groups that are dedicated to strobist techniques. There are meetups that are dedicated to photo walks. There are meetups that are dedicated to contests. And this one meetup group was dedicated to lightning. Not lighting, but lightning. L-I-G-H-T-N-I-N-G. Now, clearly, the organizer of this meetup meant to say lighting. All right, and we all pretty much got the idea from the context because it was about digital photography lightning. But my whole thought was, I don't want to go to this meetup, number one, because if it really is about lightning, I don't want to touch that. That's something that could kill me. I don't want to go around something like that. And number two, if it's about lighting, why would I want to go to a meetup where the organizer doesn't know how to spell the subject matter or can easily typo the subject matter? And that's just a question mark that's always going to hang over the idea. And I'm sure the organizer probably is very well versed in photography lighting for studio lighting or on-location lighting or portrait lighting or whatever. But that person couldn't organize their thoughts coherently enough or take the time to get it right in the written word. And that decreased the impact of that group. I'm no longer interested in participating in that group. And while that may seem like I'm being somewhat of an elitist or somewhat of a perfectionist, when the written word is all you have to communicate your message, if you don't get it right, the consequences of not getting it right can be extreme. And I think that in order for us to see this trend reverse itself, because it's been getting worse and worse and worse over time, and in order for us to see an improvement in expressing your ideas in written form, we need to start holding people accountable for such things. Because the ability to communicate your creative idea is of utmost importance, because if you create an idea and you never share it with anyone, you may as well have just never created it. The idea will die and it will never enjoy the light of day. And it's really interesting because when you look at the creative ideas and the communicative ideas, or creative talents and communicative talents, they don't exactly match, primarily because when you work in a creative format, you're not bound by rules and strictures and guidelines and sentence structures and formats and prepositions and verbs and adverbs and past tense and present tense. You don't have to deal with all that kind of stuff because it's an idea. And ideas and creativity and creative impulses can't simply, or simply just can't, be bound by rules and guidelines and all that. The only way you can really truly be creative is if you are given free rein to create from within. If you're given parameters that you must be adhered to in the creative process, well, the creative process is very much stilted and muffled in that sense. So the creative process doesn't have all these rules and strictures on it, but the communicative process does have these rules and strictures on it. And it's a shift in your mindset that you have to make when you transfer from the creative process to the communication process, and you have to recognize that. And this is most importantly associated with educators, because I have seen a lot of fantastic people who are very skilled in their fields, but who were not very good communicators. And it was unfortunate because I really wanted to learn from these people, or they had really great ideas to share. They just did not know how to share them because they were limited, or they were unaware of, or didn't take the time to understand the communicative process. And it really is important to understand at least some basics. And if you acknowledge and admit, and I've heard so many people say, I'm not the best typer, or I'm terrible with English, or, you know, it's not my fault, my teachers didn't teach me, and these are all valid points. But the problem is, if you know that you don't have the skills in that area, then you need to associate or find some people who are skilled in that area and let them help you. Because there's always someone available to help you communicate. You can take public speaking classes. You can have someone edit or proofread your work who you know is good with language. And you can avail yourself of so many resources that are out there, so that when you do express yourself orally, verbally, or in the written word, you can express yourself intelligently, coherently, and it will leave that much greater of an impression with your audience. Because not only do you have a great idea, but you're expressing it in a logical format with words that make sense, and with words that make sense together. And you're not misusing things, you don't have improper semantics, if you're writing, you don't have typos, you don't have spelling errors, you don't have word choice errors. And it just can increase the value of your message so much if you take the time to either focus on your communicative process or get some assistance in addressing the communicative process, so that when you speak to a class, or when you write a post in a forums, or when you go to publish a book, you've got some editing and some basic language skills that are available. And I can't tell you how many times in the creative world or in the business world, my background in education has been insanely helpful, because I've had to communicate complex and technical subject matter to a non-technical audience. And when you have audiences that vary in their skill sets, you really do need to be able to communicate effectively. And again, this especially goes towards people who are trying to parlay their photography and their Photoshop skills from the creative process to the instructional mode, because you need to be able to communicate that. And I'm seeing so many people that don't know how to, or refuse to admit that they need help in that area, primarily because they're so skilled in the other area, and they don't want to admit that they need help. And it really is a shame, because by acknowledging your limitations and by getting help where you need it, it can increase the impact of your message so much. And I'm just going to go ahead and leave that thought where it is, and hopefully I'll hear some back from some people on this podcast in particular to see what your thoughts are on communicating your creative ideas in written form or in verbal form, because it really is extremely useful, at least in my opinion, to be able to communicate in such a manner. So you can say to someone, here's how I created this image, here's why I created this image, and here is how you can create this image. And if you can't do that coherently or in a logical form, no one's really going to be able to understand or listen or appreciate your creative ideas to the same level that they otherwise would be able to. So I'm going to go ahead and leave the idea with that, and we'll go on in our last segment to talking about the Photoshop User Magazine and the two features in that magazine that I wanted to talk about, the Gonzo Gift Guide from Scott Kelby and 100 of the Best Photoshop Tips and Tricks. So stay tuned for our final segment to also include the Q&A for the week and the photo tip for the road. Welcome back to the final segment of the Canon Blogger Digital Podcast Series, episode number 59. In this final segment, I'm going to talk to you about the latest issue of Photoshop User Magazine, which I'm looking at right here. And this is the December issue. Where does it say it on here? It is the Gonzo Holiday Gear Guide, published from the folks over at the National Association of Photoshop Professionals. This is the December 2008 issue, and the two things I wanted to bring to your attention are the two things that are on the cover. The first is Scott Kelby's third annual Gonzo Holiday Gear Guide, and the other is the 100 Greatest Photoshop Tips. And I'm going to go into the first one here, the third annual gift guide. What this is a wish list that Scott Kelby put together on what he thinks is some of the best gear to have to increase the quality of your workflow or increase the quality of your shots, make things easier on you as a photographer. If you're interested in the first two gear guides, you can go find those over at Layers Magazine. They've since moved it over to the Photoshop User Magazine and their website, and you can also find it on Scott's blog, which is at www.scottkelby.com/blog. And what I wanted to call your attention to was on page 96, the gift guide starts on page 94, I think, 92 or 94, 94. On the second page in, he talks about two Canon bodies, two SLRs, and the first of those is the EOS 5D Mark II. This is the second iteration of the 5D. It's been long awaited by Canon users. The 5D was the only really full-frame SLR that was on the market for the longest time, and that has since been eclipsed by new releases both from Nikon and I think Pentax is the other one that released a full frame. I don't remember the second one right now off the top of my head, but the 5D Mark II has been very much anticipated. It's got super low noise, a 21.1 megapixel sensor, shoots high def video, and comes in under $3,000. It's at $26.99 retail for the body. And then the other SLR that he talks about on this page is also from Canon, the Canon 50D. And this is the next generation to the 40D. It's the next incremental update. And it's got a lot of bells and whistles. And Scott's actually looking forward to using it. I'm not sure I'm going to get it, but I did find it rather cool that he is making some acknowledgments to Canon inside his gift guide. The fact that he is probably is an indication of the quality of the gear, because Scott is a well-known Nikon shooter. So when a Nikonian starts talking about Canon gear, you know that these specific items will be definitely worth considering. And the 50D comes in at about $1,400 retail, $1,399. There are discounts available. If you're a NAP member, you can get a discount at B&H, pay no shipping, get free shipping there. And there's other various retail outlets you can go through as well where you wouldn't probably see that full retail price. But I did want to bring that to your attention on page 96. And then on page 97, Scott talks about framed prints from MPix. And I've talked up MPix before. I think I actually did a video podcast showing some prints on metallic ink that I did through MPix. And MPix is the only online printer that I use. I've used them with much success, and I'm very happy with the quality of the work that they use. If I'm ordering prints for a customer, I will order them through MPix. If customers prefer to order their own prints, my Smug Mug site does have its own fulfillment center. I'm not as crazy about those print results, but they are acceptable enough for most people. So if they want to get their own copies and save a little bit of money, Smug Mug works as well. But the quality of the prints at MPix is just great. And I'm sure many of you have heard about MPix already. If you haven't, go check them out. It's mpix.com. If you're a NAT member, I understand there's a discount forthcoming. Something cool is coming with MPix. They haven't told us yet. But you know something is cool. Or something cool is coming from them. The thing that he talks about is actually getting framed prints through MPix. Whereas in the past, you had to go get a picture printed, and then you had to mat it, and then you had to frame it, and you had to use three different facilities to do that. MPix has now rolled out the framed printing service, and I guess this is on par with the quality of the images that they've been producing. So it's very exciting to see that you can get all your fulfillment done from one resource, and I'm sure the prices will also be very competitive as well, comparatively speaking, when you look at other fulfillment options. So that was the Gonzo gift guide. The other thing I wanted to bring to your attention is the 100 greatest Photoshop tips. And the reason why I wanted to bring this to your attention is because a member of the forums by the name of Lisa Sage, who I have known through various conversations, is actually featured inside here. And she is in between Ben Wilmore and Burt Monroy on page 48. And they had a bunch of different people coming in to give 10 different tips on their particular subject matter, and Lisa is giving 10 tips about approaching Photoshop from a painterly perspective. And she gives 10 tips about using tablets, how to do textures from natural to digital, kneading the eraser tool, dry brushes, angle jitter, just a lot of really cool stuff in there. And it was also really cool to see Lisa's name in print. This is the second time she's been featured in Photoshop User Magazine. So it was very cool to see her get the kudos that she very much deserves. So congratulations go out to Lisa on her accomplishments for being featured in the 100 Greatest Photoshop Tips from Photoshop User Magazine in their December 2008 issue. That is going to wrap up the final segment. So if you'll come back in just a minute, we'll have the Q&A and then your photo tip for the road. Welcome back to Canon Blogger Digital Audio Podcast Series, episode number 59. I'm closing things out this week with a couple questions and answers, like I do every week. The first question I got this week comes from Jamie in Missouri. And Jamie writes in, she wrote to me via email. Pretty much everyone is emailing me these days. I don't see a lot of comments on the blog. But she emailed in. She asked me, what do I pack to take out on a photo walk or so as a walk-around set of gear versus what I would take to a studio set or a location shooting event where I'd probably take more equipment. Thank you to Jamie for writing in. And it's kind of interesting because I don't really have a lot of gear. As much as I am a technophile, I don't have the budget for a lot of gear. So for me, it's pretty simple. I usually just pack everything with the exception of my lights. And everything for me includes the kit lens from the XT, which was my first digital SLR, And I use that for the wider angled shots for the time being. My second lens is a macro lens. Comes from Sigma. It's a 70mm fixed focal length. And I take that with me in case I want to do some macro photography, in case something comes up. And then the third lens that I use is the 70-200L. And this gives me a fair amount of zoom on top of my body so that I can zoom out and take something from a distance. In addition to that, I do have a 1.4 Kenko extender, which will extend the range of the 70-200 if I need it. And all of this, all three of these lenses fit on my 40D, which is the SLR that I upgraded to from the XT. And I usually will also take my 550EX with me on a shoot if I'm going on a photo walk or just as a walk-around lens for photojournalism, where I don't want to be carrying a whole lot of extra gear. You notice I did not say a monopod or a tripod. If I'm on a photo walk, I'm on the go, I'm moving around, I don't want to be bothered with setting up a tripod. I might use a monopod depending on the time of day, if it's going to be at dusk or things of that nature, where I'm not sure if I'll have natural methods for stabilizing my camera. I might take my monopod, I might not, it'll depend. But for the most part, that's what I will take on a photo walk or on some kind of walk-around gear set. Now, in a studio location or a location shooting environment, I will, of course, have everything. And by everything, meaning I will add my tripod. I will definitely my tripod. I have two light stands. I've got some monolights, Smith & Victor monolights, as well as a flash umbrella. And sometimes, depending on the scenario, I may also use my laptop for tethered shooting. I haven't had an opportunity to do that yet, but I can see that coming around the bend for me. So that would probably also be something I would take on a location lighting or a studio lighting event where I'm going to be pretty much stationary. So thank you to Jamie for writing in with that question. Hopefully that was a good answer for you. Moving on, our second question today comes in from New York, and I actually used to live in New York, so shout outs to New Yorkers. This comes in from Colin, and he writes in to ask, Jason, which do you like better, natural light or strobe and studio light? It's an interesting question, Colin, because it really depends on what you're shooting. And for me personally, most of my work thus far has been in a landscape environment or on photo walks or in a photojournalism type of environment, to where natural light is preferred because that's how the scene looks. I want to capture how the scene looks as opposed to adding my own light to the scene and changing the scene, because I don't really have a vision of what I want to capture. I just look at events as they occur around me and capture what catches my eye. So in those environments, I really prefer natural light. Having said that, when I have gone into studio events or product work or portrait work, things of that nature, I have started to use flash on a more regular basis. Obviously, I have because I've picked up two monolights and light stands to aid me in those endeavors. But it really, again, it just goes back to where you're shooting and what you're shooting. And that's not to say that you can't use strobes, flashes, studio lights, etc. on location. If you can port them around, they're kind of heavy. I don't like to port them around. I can't imagine many people would. But if you're so inclined, you could very well do that to light a landscape. I know a lot of strobists actually have done that kind of thing. And alternatively, there's nothing to say that you can't use natural light in portrait or product work or in a studio environment if the natural lighting for that scenario happens to be what you're going for. So it really just comes down to what you're going for in terms of looking at light. And that actually brings up an interesting concept, looking at light, because I wrote an article that actually talks about how to look at light and what to look for when you're considering light for your subject matter. And I go into a little bit of this, the landscape versus the portrait work or product work or event lighting or photojournalism lighting, And that article is going to be featured in the November issue of Photography BB Magazine, which should be coming out soon. And I'm sure I'll have a post up on the blog when that does get published, so you can go and download it there. For the time being, I'll put a link to the Photography BB website, because that really is also a great resource. But getting back to Colin's question, it really depends on the situation. Natural light works in some environments. Strobes and studios work in other environments. There's nothing to say you can't mix them up and use whatever lighting works best for your needs in any given environment. But for the most part, I've noticed natural light works best in landscape and photojournalism, whereas strobe studio type lights work better in events, portrait, and or product photography type work. So thank you to Colin for writing in on that. The last question for today comes into us from, or comes into me, from Alan in Florida. And Alan asks, what is the best magazine to read? There are so many magazines out there, I don't know which ones to get, which ones to avoid. Can you make any recommendations? This is a great question, Alan. Thank you so much for writing this in. And I'm going to give kind of a similar answer to the question that Colin asked about lighting. And the answer is that it depends. And the reason why it depends is because of what you're looking for. Different magazines serve different purposes. So to answer that question, I'm going to tell you the magazines that I subscribe to. And this isn't to say that these are the preferred ones or the best ones. These are the ones that I find most useful for the type of information they're giving at the best price. There are some better magazines out there. There's a couple I'm interested in. But until I find one of these that I'm willing to give up, I don't want to add another subscription to my list, because I do have quite a few. The first magazine that I subscribe to is PC Photo Magazine. PC Photo is a great magazine for keeping up on the technical side of things, the gear associated with digital photography, whether it is the lenses, the bodies, the computer equipment that you use for post-processing, different software options, things of that nature. On the technical side of things, PC Photo, I think, is probably one of the better ones. That is, again, just my personal opinion. The second magazine that I subscribe to is Popular Photography. Everyone pretty much knows about this one. It's kind of a light read. I can read that in 5-10 minutes. But it keeps me up to date on a lot of the photo news, the industry news that's going on, what's coming down the pike, new things that have been released. And if I'm interested in them, I'll go to the website, or I'll go to PC Photo or some other magazine to get more detailed information. But it's a great light read. If you want to just get up to date bullets, little snippets of information, Popular Photography is a great resource. The other thing I like about that is they have a lot of photos in there. They'll have contests, they'll have photos that they fix or things of that nature, and it's a great resource to tap into for that purpose. So Popular Photography is something that I would consider recommending to people who were interested in purchasing a subscription. The third magazine I subscribe to, and there are three more, is Shutterbug Magazine. Shutterbug actually has really great articles. If I want to sit down and have a really good read over some morning coffee or while I'm watching a football game or something of that nature, Shutterbug is the magazine that I turn to for during commercials or when I've got some time to kill because I want to really delve into something. And Shutterbug is the resource that I go to for that. They've got really great articles on how to do different things, on just even subject matter that I hadn't thought about before. So Shutterbug Magazine is good in that vein. I've already talked about Photoshop User Magazine from Map. That is a fantastic resource. They've got tips, they've got tricks, they've got tutorials, they've got articles, they've got workflow, they've got color management. Just tons of stuff in there. Photoshop User Magazine, of course, is pretty well-renowned. They've got a lot of great writers in there. Of course, they've got Scott Kelby, they've got Matt Kloskowski, Dave Cross, they've got Ben Wilmore in here, now Lisa Sage is in here, Burt Monroy is in here, Alan Hess, Troy Hitch, Kevin Ames, Sean Duggan, just a lot of really well-known names. I think I've even seen articles in here from Joe McNally, John Paul Caponegro, just amazing, amazing writers. So it comes highly recommended. And this one I do use for a software reference. So if I want to learn how to do something in Photoshop, I will turn to the NAP forums, the NAP website for tutorials, tips, and tricks, and then their magazines that they issue periodically throughout the year. I think you get 8 issues a year from this. There might be 10, I don't remember for sure. But it's an 8-issue subscription or a 10-issue subscription, a really great resource for software trends, tips, and tricks, specifically when it comes to Adobe products like Photoshop, Photoshop Lightroom, CS3, CS4, even Elements is a subject that a Photoshop user hits on occasionally. So that is a fantastic resource for that. And last but not least is Rangefinder magazine. Rangefinder is an excellent resource, especially for inspiration. They've just got some amazing photographs in there. I could recommend the National Geographic magazine. Just some incredible images in there. Rangefinder has really good articles too. Just actually some excellent writing. Talk about taking ideas and putting them in written form. Rangefinder is the magazine that does that probably better than any other magazine, in my opinion. So those are the ones that I use for various purposes. Those, again, are PC Photo, Popular Photography, Shutterbug, Photoshop User, and Rangefinder. And I'll go ahead and throw another one in there, even though I'm not a subscriber, and that will be National Geographic. Just from the sheer inspirational perspective, it's just amazing. So that is the Q&A for this week. Thank you very much to Alan, Colin, and Jamie for writing in. If anyone else does have questions that they'd like to have answered on the weekly podcast series, please feel free to email. The address, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. Taking you out now, and my road tip, this actually speaks to printing your work. And one thing I've always found that's pretty helpful when you go to print your work is that if you want to put your final output at whatever size it is, whether it's a 16 by 20, 11 by 17, 11 by 14, 8 by 10, whatever size you want to be for your final output, always print one right before that as a proof print and make it one size smaller. So, for example, if you're going to print a 16 by 20, you want to proof it at 11 by 14. If you're going to print an 11 by 14, you want to proof it at an 8 by 10. And if you want to print an 8 by 10, likewise, you would proof that at a 5 by 7 size. And the reason why is because you can catch pretty much everything in the smaller size print. There may be the off chance that you'll see something in the larger print that you didn't see in the smaller one, but most of the time, you can pick out any flaws from the smaller size print so that you don't waste a lot of ink and paper, which can get very expensive if you're printing things yourself, on a big old sheet of paper that's just dumped half a cartridge of ink. So I would always recommend running a proof print first at a one size smaller than your actual final output. Now the exception to this would of course be things like a 5x7, a 4x6, or a wallet sized image, primarily because they don't use a lot of ink to knock out one of those, and the cost of the paper is negligible. You can get a 50 pack of 4x6 paper for $10-$12 these days. So the cost per print is so low on those smaller sizes that you really don't need to go smaller on a proof print. You can just keep it at the output size. But when you start getting into bigger prints, highly recommend that you do a proof print. And that's just a good idea so you can see if there's anything that you missed that could be corrected before final output. So that's the road tip for this week. I wanted to thank everyone for taking the time to tune in and listen to canonblogger.com, the digital podcast series. If you're interested in having future subjects discussed in the podcast, or if you'd like to participate in the podcast, please feel free to stop over to the blog, which is at www.canonblogger.com. Share your idea in the comments section. Doesn't matter which day you choose to post on, I'll see it. Or you can always email me, as I said in the Q&A section. You can email me at jason@canonblogger.com. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you back next week. Bye.